Thank you for joining us today on the Ole Mole, Jakob Reisberg.
Great to be here.
In 2020, the ACLU filed a class action lawsuit against the sheriff in Santa Ana, California, calling for the release of vulnerable and disabled people in the Orange County Jail and for addressing other health conditions at the jails. Well, you are policy counsel at ACLU and part of the legal team on this ongoing lawsuit. Can you talk about the significance of the case, which specifically addressed the impact of COVID on incarcerated persons?
Sure. I think to understand the significance of the case, it's worth just trying to take yourself back in time to the beginning of the pandemic and to think about what it was like to experience COVID at the very beginning when we didn't know very much about COVID itself. We didn't know how it was transmitted. And we certainly didn't know how to protect ourselves against it. And what we started to see were these instances of mass outbreaks that were happening in confined spaces. So I don't know if you remember, Jan, the story of the cruise ship at the very beginning of the pandemic, where people were in close quarters, unable to be separate from each other. And that was a site of mass infection where essentially everyone was exposed.
And I think there was some outpouring of sympathy for these people that were confined under conditions not of their own choosing. And of course, jails and prisons are much worse than cruise ships and didn't elicit that same empathic response. We saw those cruise ships every night for a while in the news.
That's exactly right. And I think that part of the reason, just as you said there, that there wasn't as much of a public response based in empathy was because while the passengers on the cruise ship might be easy to empathize with or were shown in mass media, people in jail systems across the country are purposefully hidden away, sort of out of public sight and out of public mind, unless you're someone, as many people in this country do, who has a loved one who's on the inside and who could tell them what was going on. And that's exactly what we heard at ACLU SoCal was phone calls from people inside the Orange County Jail, which, by the way, is the second biggest jail system in the entire state of California. With at the beginning of the pandemic, over 6,000 people inside on average on a day-to-day basis. And we would be getting phone calls. I was getting phone calls from people inside the jail saying, "What's going on? They're not giving us the newspaper. They're censoring certain articles. They're cutting things out. They've shut off the TVs. We know that there's something happening, called COVID, but we don't know anything about it, and we don't know how to pr protect ourselves. And on top of that, we don't have enough cleaning supplies. They've not given us soap. We're running out of toilet paper because that, too, as you remember, there were these mass rushes for supplies, not just in jail systems, but on the outside as well, where suddenly the shelves were empty, and that was affecting people inside the jail systems as well. And it got more and more to a state of just panic with people saying, "I don't know if I'm going to live or die in here. I don't know if I'm ever going to see my kids again or see my grandkids again." And it was that at the very beginning that made us say, "Okay, we need to try to do something immediate." And in the legal world, that basically means file a lawsuit.
One practical response was the push to release people who are incarcerated, who are no real risk to the community and are facing greater risks in jails and prisons.
Absolutely.
So that was part of this lawsuit, but I assume there's a series of steps before filing a class action lawsuit where you try to get the officials to respond.
Yes. And in some jail systems in the state, officials were more amenable to responding. The LA County jails took far more steps to depopulate because, just as you say, lowering the population, especially at that phase in the pandemic when we didn't have vaccines, and really the only way to ensure the safety, especially the safety of vulnerable people or the elderly or pregnant people, was to depopulate and just say, we're going to let you go because we think it's more of a public safety risk to keep you in here in this confined space where you could be exposed to this deadly virus or will be exposed to this deadly virus than it is to just let you go.
And do prison staff, correction officers enter into this at all? Because I know that was a part of the mix of the dynamics, was correction officers also bringing in infection from their own communities and also being infected, and fewer of them to provide whatever care is available.
Absolutely. And one of our main arguments for why the only solution was depopulation was because it's just the reality of the day-to-day in and out of correction staff that COVID would be entering the jail. Because at the end of the day, the day shift goes home, they go to their community, they get exposed to other people in their community, and then they come back in the next day. And that, we argued, was one of the major risk points of transmission into the jails, and basically meant it was a guarantee that COVID would come in, and it did.
How important is it in how these cases play out that prison staff, correction officers, who tend to be very politically conservative in terms of how defending these institutions and their growth, did they weigh into it in any different way or a way that was important in the dynamics of the lawsuit itself?
In terms of the lawsuit, there wasn't as much of an effect that came from individual jail staff. And by the way, the jail system is separate from the California prison system. And this case was focused solely on Orange County jails. So we didn't receive so much pushback from individual staff. Where there was substantial pushback was from the Correctional Officers Union, who basically said to the sheriff's department, there's no way we're going to agree to mandatory testing. There's no way that we're going to agree to leave that was connected to when someone was found out to be sick. Or there's no way that we're going to agree to mandatory vaccination, which came later down the line. So I think there was an impact by the institutional actor of the union more than by individual correctional staff.
And can you explain a bit briefly why that is? Why that has been such an obstacle to the movement for meaningful prison reform?
That's a great question. I don't think there's a simple answer, but what I do think is undeniably true is that correctional officers unions, much like police officers unions and sheriff personnel unions, are political actors that have political desires, that make strategic decisions to further those political desires. And I think it's a mistake. And I think it's a mistake that's made quite a lot in mainstream media and by many politicians, to assume that law enforcement interests are inherently neutral. I think that's a premise we need to reject. And we can point as evidence to instances like these, where there were clearly political decisions being made on behalf of the deputies by the union that were guaranteed to have negative health consequences for the people stuck inside the jail.
So maybe you can give us an update on where the case is now and what some of the dynamics are in the victory or the obstacles of these cases, whether community support is important, or how you organize beyond filing the brief and putting together good arguments and compelling cases to illustrate the class. I know in looking at the brief, it was, there's some very compelling individual cases that were thought to be compelling in arguing kind of morally for the lawsuit.
We're now more than 2 years after the start of the case, and it now has settled. Both sides have agreed to a settlement agreement as of about 2 months ago, or a little more than 2 months ago. And the settlement basically says that the Sheriff's Department needs to ensure safety inside the jails, COVID safety inside the jails, in a bunch of different ways, like making sure that vaccines remain available and making sure that there are good isolation procedures if there are COVID exposures, things like that. I think some of the bigger victories that aren't solely because of the case but are connected to it is that the jail population is way down. I mentioned that on average, at the beginning of COVID, the daily population in Orange County jails was around 6,000 people. It's now around 3,300 or 3,400, so almost half. And that was a combination of the litigation, lobbying of these institutional actors, and grassroots political pressure that basically said the status quo cannot stand. Some other things that I think are really important to recognize are, number one, the laws themselves are very unfavorable to incarcerated people. One of the reasons we settled was because we thought it was the best we could get and it was in our client's best interest. Because if we had gone to trial, there would have been a high likelihood that we would not have gotten as good a result for our clients. And that's because the deck is stacked in terms of the statutes, in terms of the case law, in terms of who the judges are on the courts on average and their perceptions of incarcerated people and what rights they deserve. All of those things make it an uphill battle for incarcerated people to basically demand dignity, humanity, safety. And so I do think that for me, one of the core lessons is that key to the fight, if not the biggest key to the fight, needs to be community-based organizing and grassroots organizing. And I say that as an attorney who's sort of working on cases all the time. I think the grassroots organizing is the only way that we will win liberation and meaningful dignity, meaningful safety, and eventual abolition of jail and prisons. And one last thing that I just wanted to add was, I do think that part of the strategy, just as you said, needs to be showing people and telling people, here are the human beings who are inside of the jails. Here's the pregnant mother who has to pump her milk and then, or excuse me, the mother who had just given birth, who pumps her milk and has her spouse pick it up at the jail. Or here's the 80-year-old grandfather who's inside still, despite the fact that he's already been inside for multiple decades. It's especially effective if people on the outside can hear from those people in their own words, with audio recording or other ways of reading people in their own words, rather than having it be transmitted via a lawsuit or some other way like that. But I do think that that's essential to the picture. I also think, and this is the last point I'll make, that I did see people on the outside start to get it, in the sense of seeing the interconnectedness between people on the outside and people on the outside. And I think that was directly because of the pandemic. And what I mean by that is, if you're on the outside and there's a rampant outbreak of COVID at the Orange County jail, those people are going to have to go to the hospital, and they're going to fill up the hospital beds in Orange County. And so that when you on the outside get sick, or your child gets sick, there's not going to be a hospital bed free for you to get care. And that was the reality. That's not that that happened not just in Orange County, but all over, where there were hospitals at 0% capacity, in part due to these concentrated outbreaks. And so I think that helped people on the outside start to realize, oh, there's actually an interconnectedness between what happens here on the outside and what's happening inside the jails.
And of course, jails and prisons, perhaps particularly by design, are ought to be removed from people psychologically and geographically and physically. So I think that that point is so important, as well as having a little bit of a feeling of being trapped or confined under conditions not of your own choosing. Of course, there's a big difference between that, what we all experience, and incarceration, but it did seem to open up possibilities for different levels of understanding, as you say, of our interdependency and shared humanity. So I hope you come on the program again to continue to follow this and this important broader work. Is there a place people can go to for an update on the case? I was looking online today and didn't see a recent update. You can also get back to me on that if there's something coming up.
I can get back to you on that. I think we're waiting to see what happens with this winter and whether there are new variants or new outbreaks that may lead to us trying to reopen the case in some meaningful form.
Okay, so hopefully we'll have you back on the show to talk further. Thank you so much, Jakob Reisberg, for being with us today, and keep up the good work.
Thank you for having me.